News, it's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. So far, only one bill aimed at restricting abortion has been filed this legislative session, but this measure isn't expected to go anywhere with Democrats in control of the New Hampshire House and the corner office. During the last session, however, abortion was actively on the agenda, and several bills became law. One requires minors notify their parents before having an abortion. Another outlaws so-called partial birth abortions, repeating a federal ban on this procedure. In addition, the legislature debated other proposals, including a 24-hour waiting period, no government funding to help providers who perform abortions, and bans on abortions after 20 weeks. Although these debates have been heard in other states for years, they were relatively new to the Granite State. For a long time, at least since the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision legalized abortion 40 years ago this month, our state's libertarian leanings and the fact that we're one of the least religious states meant that many people here don't use the Bible as an argument against abortion. Today in The Exchange, 40 years after Roe v. Wade, we look at the arc of abortion politics and policies in the Granite State, and let's hear from you. Over the years, how have you seen this issue evolve in New Hampshire? What role do you see abortion playing in our politics over time? And how do you see our state's take on abortion as different from other states? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. With us in studio, three guests: Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, lead writer for thelobbynh.com. Kevin, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Wonderful to be back.
Also with us, Susan Arnold, chair of NARAL Pro-Choice New Hampshire. Susan, good to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us, Fran Wendelboe, assistant secretary of the New Hampshire Republican State Committee and a former Republican representative from New Hampton. And Fran, welcome back to you. Good to see you.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Well, Fran, to you first. When Americans put themselves in one camp or the other on this issue, either pro or con, it's not as clear as it might seem. What gray areas do you see, Fran, in terms of how the American public feels today about abortion 40 years after the Supreme Court decision?
I think it's crystal clear in the total concept of it. The pro-life people believe that life begins at conception. And because there is a life, there are two interested parties, not just the mother. On the other hand, you have your pro-choice people who believe that it's a woman's right to choose, that it's a woman's right to privacy, to do what she wishes with her body. There is no meeting of the minds there. One believes I can do anything I want with this unborn child. The other believes you're killing a life. So there is no gray area. Where the gray area becomes, and Roe v. Wade actually allowed a lot of gray area, it wasn't an absolute right to an abortion. The gray area is things like parental notification, 24-hour wait periods, informed consent, licensing of providers. Roe talked about doctors. Doctors don't do abortions exclusively anymore. We have nurses doing abortions now. So there's a whole big area in the middle, and that's why the polls are so hard to follow, because the great majority of people feel that abortion should not be allowed to exist for any time, any reason at all. So that's where you get the big difference.
Yeah, and that's a point that others have made. So to follow up on that with you, Susan Arnold, Fran said and others have said Roe v. Wade allowed a lot of gray, even though, you know, one side feels one way and another side feels the other way. There is a lot of gray here.
Yes, I think, in fact, the decision itself is quite clear in terms of how it lays out a set of responsibilities based on the trimester of pregnancy. So in the first trimester, very clear, no state restrictions is how it reads. And the second trimester, some state restriction allowed, state regulation. And in the third trimester, there becomes a new state interest. And so, in fact, even prohibiting is allowable. But the gray area that Fran is referencing, I think, comes from a lot of subsequent decisions that started to come down in the late 80s and early 90s. Webster, Casey, And some prior decisions as well. But, I will agree with Fran. I think there are some very fundamental differences here in the pro-choice position and the anti-choice position. And I think that we come at the issue just from a very fundamentally different place about the need for individual autonomy and the ability of women to make their own choices in consultation with their physician, with their minister, or with their family, and that's really the fundamental right that Roe is talking about. It's about the right to self-autonomy, to individual privacy, all of which I think are really fundamental values here in New Hampshire.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about New Hampshire. And Kevin Landergan, to you, so over these past 40 years, again, since the Roe v. Wade decision, what's been New Hampshire's general attitude toward abortion, Kevin?
Yeah, I think, as you pointed out in the opening, New Hampshire generally has been a pro-choice state, even since Roe versus Wade. It's one of the reasons why while Republicans have dominated in this state really until the last decade in terms of seats in the legislature, attempts to severely restrict abortion have never gotten very far. I think one of the reasons is this libertarian nature you speak of. I think personal privacy is a big piece of this. And there are a lot of conservative Republican legislators I've spoken to over the years, some who surprise me, that essentially oppose severe restrictions on abortion. Their argument essentially is the following, that I certainly would not counsel my daughter or my niece to have an abortion, but I don't want the government totally limiting options for other people. And I think that's one of the reasons why this pro-choice position has always taken hold here, because as you know, in New Hampshire, there's a big premium on personal privacy. We're the only state that rejected real ID. We allow people not to put Social Security numbers on their driver's licenses. There's a lot of pushback, even the people in this state, for joining Easy Pass because they don't want to essentially be followed electronically and their whereabouts known. I think that's the paradigm we're talking about.
So we don't want
about.
Government involved in what we consider personal decisions. That's been the attitude here.
Exactly.
Real quickly, yeah. Kevin, and then I want to get back to our other guests as well. Sure. That changed about 10 years ago with the election of Republican Craig Benson after Democrat Jean Shaheen decided not to run for re-election. We started to see a shift in abortion politics in New Hampshire.
We did, and I think it corresponded with kind of these wave elections that we've talked about here on this program in the past. In 2002, Republicans won a supermajority in the legislature, the same kind of majority in the New Hampshire House, about 3-1, that existed in 2010. It's important to point that out because that's kind of the arc of this debate over parental notification. Craig Benson comes into office with a very Republican legislature, passes parental notification. Planned Parenthood and other groups essentially sue over the law, arguing that it's constitutionally flawed. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Kelly Ayotte was the Attorney General, now the U.S. Senator. She argued the case in Supreme Court. Essentially, the court said that the exception to protect the health of the mother had a constitutional problem with it. It didn't actually strike down the law. It sent it down to a lower court. But that essentially nullified the law in New Hampshire. And John Lynch gets elected, Democrat, a very pro-choice Democrat, convinces the legislature to actually take the parental law off the books. And that's what I mean by these. We kind of came full circle. 2010 comes, another supermajority Republican, 3-1 majority in both the House and the Senate. So even with a Democratic governor, they're able to reinstate the parental notification law. And passed it over his veto.
Well, and parental notification, health exceptions, these have been two big issues that we've seen elsewhere in the country. And I want to ask you, Susan and Fran, both about them. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. How have you seen this issue of abortion evolve in New Hampshire over the 40 years since Roe v. Wade? What role have you seen abortion play in our politics over that time? And how do you see our state's take on abortion, our attitudes, our approaches, as different from other states. Again, that number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Susan Arnold, I think to you, Kevin mentioned the parental notification law, and that was a big deal here in New Hampshire, as he outlined. Now we do have a parental notification law in the books. I remember doing programs on this where people would call in and they would say, I consider myself in favor of abortion rights, but parents have a right to be involved. So even people who you might call pro-choice, using your language, were in favor of parental notification.
Yeah, and I want to correct one thing here. Parental notification or parental consent, these bills have been around for a very long time. I have a statistic here that since 1982, the legislature has considered such bills 16 times. And rejected them 14 times.
Right.
So this is not a new issue. And a lot of these other, you know, mandatory waiting periods and all that, they've really been around since the late 80s and 90s. So a lot of this stuff is just, it's a lot of recycling, and we're seeing it again now. But to your point about parental notification, it is probably one of the more difficult arguments that we need to make about where the government really needs to be involved. And I think that's the simplest way to think of it. Would you rather have the government involved in basically your family communication? I think the facts and the statistics about young women who do obtain abortions are that the vast majority of them involve a family member or another trusted adult in that decision-making process. It's a very small percentage who don't. And that small percentage usually have a very good reason. Their pregnancy may be the result of rape or incest from a family member. They may have a very troubled family life,
and
or
that's
violence.
Where then the judicial bypass comes into effect. If you have that situation, supposedly these laws say you can go to a judge and get him or her to help you out.
Yeah, and I would put a big emphasis on the word supposedly, because I think that that mechanism is a very challenging one. And as you saw, like last year, we came back to try to deal with how much time the courts would have to make those decisions. And then you have small towns where everybody knows everybody and you're showing up in the local court. How much privacy is that for a young girl?
All right. And Fran, I know you want to jump in on this too. We'll get to you after a short break. And we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. Don't let your NHPR member card expire. Renew it today to take advantage of January's benefit of the month. That's a 2-for-1 admission to the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center in Concord. Visit nhpr.org for a complete list of all member card benefits and to get your own card. Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from the Frost School, announcing its name change to Plymouth State University's Division of Online and Continuing Studies, sending best wishes for achieving your goals in the new year. And from Dr. Rod Burdett and Riverview Dental of Concord, offering mini dental implants for denture stabilization and tooth replacement. Information at 228-1066. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, 40 years since Roe v. Wade, we're looking at abortion policy over these many years in the Granite State. And we invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on the Exchange page at nhpr.org or on our Facebook page. Tell us how you have seen this issue evolve and change here in New Hampshire, what role you've seen abortion playing in our politics over time. Also, if you want to jump in on some of the gray areas that we've talked about, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Fran Wendell Bowe, I'm guessing that parental notification, which we talked about before the break, is one of those gray areas where, you know, you've got people on supposedly both sides coming to some agreement.
And you should. And, you know, I sat in that courtroom when the United States Supreme Court heard Ayotte, and I am very intimate with the decision, and I think it was a good decision. You know, I think, listening to Susan a minute ago, there is no common ground. I do not know of a single piece of legislation, pro-life legislation, that Planned Parenthood or NARAL has ever come forward and said, gosh, that's a good idea. Even the parental notification, you hear how all of a sudden it's like, oh, if somebody sees a girl going into a courtroom, they're going to assume she's going in to get a judicial bypass. So does that mean police officers shouldn't give them tickets for smoking or traffic offenses? Because everybody's going to immediately assume the reason that girl's going into that courthouse is for. I mean, it's that kind of atmosphere of fear that they try to put into people of how your rights are going to be damaged if there's any type of restriction. Their position has always been anytime, any place, for any reason.
What about the judicial bypass, though? There have been some people who've said, look, this is a problem. There's weekends, there's holidays. New Hampshire courts are understaffed. They're closed sometimes due to budget cuts. So it's not as simple, they say, as it sounds.
They've made it a priority. And if it says what the reason is, they're supposed to drop everything else and take that bypass.
Judges are.
Yes. And, you know, it's really kind of funny. I had a legislator call me a while back, and he said, you know, I really need your advice on something. He said, my wife and I were having a discussion last night, and we're both pro-choice. He said, but I was looking at my voting record. And he says, and every single bill that was considered pro-life, I supported. So am I pro-choice or am I pro-life? And I said, I consider you pro-life. There's some areas of disagreement. And I think a lot of people in America are considering themselves pro-life with some parameters. You know, parental notification, I know very few parents who would say, I think it's a great idea that my daughter should be able to hide from me the fact that she got pregnant and go have a surgical medical procedure without me knowing about it or being able to give health information to that physician or be prepared for any complications. But, you know, I've faced this personally. We've talked in the past. I have failed as a super uber conservative. My son did end up with his girlfriend becoming pregnant. And while I was disappointed in that they didn't wait for marriage, I was so very, very proud of him. First, for having chosen a young woman that had the same moral values, that respected life, and there was no discussion of abortion. It was inconvenient. They were still in college.
I'm just curious. Yeah.
Jonathan was 21, mm-hmm. and Alicia was 20. And so they had that baby. And I have to admit, I failed twice. My younger son, same situation, baby before marriage. But I would never have given up the three beautiful grandchildren that I have now. And as a mother, I just cannot believe that anybody who has experienced birth could ever terminate a life. I understand that there are times that it's inconvenient. And you have to realize that 97-98% of abortions are over convenience. Convenience. That's a shame.
Let's talk real quickly to you, Susan, about the parental notification. Again, a tricky issue, and then we really should go to our listeners.
Sure. Well, I mean, I obviously sympathize with Fran's story, but I guess what I would say is if you don't think a young woman is responsible enough to make her own decision about whether or not to bear a child, do you think she's responsible enough to raise a child? That's a real concern. Clearly, Fran is providing a lot of support to her sons and their families. She was there for them. There are a lot of young women that aren't that lucky, that don't have a parental figure like Fran. So, you know, that to me is the question. You think these young women are not mature enough to make an important decision about whether or not to bear a child, yet you think they should be mothers. I think that's a really flawed logic and a fundamental problem with the argument against parental notification or consent.
All right, lots of calls, and let's go to them now. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Try to keep those emails short, if you could. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go first to John waiting in Manchester. Hi, John. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, no problem. I just had three quick points, and then I'll take off the air there.
Sure.
My first sort of point is that the terminology around this issue is just kind of ridiculous and divisive. I mean, it means that half of people are anti-choice and half of people are anti-life, which I think it's not a really good place to talk about an issue from. Second, the whole idea that if you're pro-life, you have to believe that conception begins at birth, that's a modern, you know, like in the last 20 years invention. And until the 80s, evangelicals, Christians, you know, Billy Graham, thought that abortion was basically okay up until the fetus was born. Not partial birth abortion, but the idea being that in the Bible it says that, you know, if you take a human life, surely you'll be killed. But if you kill a fetus, you're not supposed to be killed in the Bible. So the idea being that logically, therefore, a fetus is not a human life. I'm pro-life, and I think that until the viability of the fetus, that's the point at which, you know, you should not be able to kill it, because then it's a baby, because it's viable outside the mother. And then the third point is, with Roe versus Wade, if we have a right to privacy, why are we still fighting over sick people getting medical marijuana in this state?
Okay. Well, lots of points, John, and I'll leave the medical marijuana one aside at this point. That's for another show, when we will probably be covering that issue. But here's something interesting that he did mention, and I wanted to ask all of you about it. This idea of life beginning at conception, and Fran, you brought that up. John's saying he's pro-life, to use his terminology, but he doesn't believe life begins at conception. Here's my question, Fran. How has technology changed our ideas around this idea of fetal viability? You can see a lot more than you used to be able to see in utero, and you can babies can survive being born a lot younger than they used to be able to. So a lot of issues around this issue of fetal viability 40 years ago have changed.
Well, it was a big part of the Roe v. Wade debate, viability, and where that fell, and that's where the trimester came in, the first trimester. Then it became viability, and as you all know, viability used to be considered almost term. You know, now it's 20 weeks, and I think it might even go past that in the future. You have ultrasounds where you actually see the baby, and, you know, life beginning at conception is a biological fact. It's not somebody someday woke up and said, you know, I think life begins at conception. You know, within 2 weeks, you have a beating heart. You have brain activity starting. It is a preborn life. Obviously not able to live outside the womb at that point in time. But, you know, it's really funny. At one of the legislative hearings, a certain lobbyist testified and mentioned that they had had a miscarriage at about 10 or 11 weeks, and that it looked like a little shrimp. Well, I had just received a picture of a fetus at that same time frame, 11 or 12 weeks, and I had stuck it on the refrigerator. And my granddaughter Emily was about 18 months at the time, and I was holding her and went to get the milk out of the refrigerator. And she looked at the picture and she pointed at it and went, "Baby." So, you know, even though it's not nowhere near term, it looks like a baby.
You know what I'm curious about, too? John mentioned, and this is for you, Kevin Landrigan, John mentioned, again, the issue of terminology, you know, pro-life, pro-choice. He doesn't like this language. Yeah, he calls it ridiculous. NPR actually has standards. We are supposed to say abortion rights, and then we're supposed to say anti-abortion. That's right. What we're supposed to use. How do you, as a reporter, use this kind of language? John's right. It gets some people upset.
Yeah, it does, because it tends to divide folks into camps, as John pointed out. I mean, the term pro-life, for example, does that mean everybody who supports abortion rights doesn't support life? And the converse is true. That's why we have the same standard at the Telegraph. We always refer to folks as either supportive of restrictions on abortion or against restrictions on abortion. And
it's not as tidy and easy as pro-life, pro-choice.
And that's why you use that term restrictions on abortion, because as we pointed out at the beginning of the show, there are gray areas here, and there are folks who support a woman's right to have reproductive freedom, but also support some limits on that right, particularly at the later stages of a pregnancy.
Well, let's take another call. This is Anne in White River. I'm sorry. Did you want to jump in, Susan?
I just wanted to make the point that I think language is a constant issue here. And, you know, again, listening to Fran talking about it's always about convenience, 90%, you know, or abortion on demand, anytime, any place. That is really using language, I think, to frame up a very negative portrayal of a woman who has an unplanned pregnancy, who is trying to grapple with what is the best life decision for her family. and her life. And so I would argue that it goes a lot further than pro-choice, pro-life, anti, and that, in fact, the language being used around this issue, particularly by Fran and her anti-choice colleagues, are really trying to frame up this idea that a woman just is not capable of making an informed decision herself, that she needs government, that she needs mandatory counseling, that she needs people to be telling her what it is she should be thinking. And I think that so that the language that is used in a lot of these bills and in a lot of the rhetoric goes well beyond just those labels to really try to shape the debate in a very pernicious way, I would argue.
Well, John, I'm glad you raised it, because clearly language is an issue here. We've been talking about it. Fran, I want to let you jump in real quickly on that, too, the issue of language.
Yeah, I know. You know, if you can sugarcoat death, it's always easier. You know, and the people who consider themselves pro-life, it isn't only the abortion issue. It's the euthanasia issue. It's the death penalty issue. They consider themselves pro-life in a number of different areas. It's semantics. If some people think abortion rights supporters is, you know, sugarcoated enough, okay, I'll give it to them.
There are people who are against abortion but favor the death penalty, so.
There are, and there are some people who consider themselves very pro-life on the abortion issue but are very more compassionate-leaning when it comes to end-of-life issues. So there's a wide various array dealing with life and death issues.
Well, John, I'm glad you called, because his call showed how much gray area there is, and again, the importance of language. So thank you, John. Let's go to Ann in White River Junction. Ann, thank you for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Laura, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was born before the legalization of abortion, and witnessed my best friend in a... I guess she'd had an illegal abortion. She was 16 years old, and I was called to the bathroom, and it's still with me, that horrible sight of my girlfriend bleeding, and her mother had taken her to one because there was no other place to go. She'd had a scholarship to a very good university, and, you know, it was just a very upsetting time for me, and I still dream about it sometimes. Now, apparently, in that time, the only place you could go would be to Europe, and they didn't have any money to do that for a legal abortion. So, you know, she was a child. She was a kid. She had a big future ahead of her. She'd been accepted at college, and it changed her whole life. They made her marry the guy, and they were two really good kids.
So she had the child then?
She did not.
She did not.
She had an illegal abortion, one of those backyard abortions that she never was able to have a child again.
Uh-huh.
It was brutal. And,
so she ended up having to marry the boyfriend anyway,
yeah,
though?
Yeah. She had to marry. I had to have a shower, you know, a wedding shower for her, because these things weren't talked about. They weren't brought to the front. And I still love this girl, and she's still alive. She's had no children. She's had a good career. But it's very sad that people don't mention that the opposite of a legal abortion is an illegal abortion, and they were brutal.
Yeah.
They were awful.
Thank you for calling, Anne. I know that's a difficult story for you to tell. Susan, do you want to jump in there, and then maybe Fran, and then I've got another question for all of you.
Yeah, I think Anne really brings to the fore exactly how significant the Roe v. Wade decision was. It took out of the back alley, out of these butcher shops, something that was happening. When women have a pregnancy that they know is not the right thing for them or their family at that time, that they cannot manage, they are going to figure out a way to end that pregnancy. And that has happened always and will always continue to happen. And Roe v. Wade enabled that process to become 11 times safer than childbirth to have an abortion, to be done legally, safely, without women having the horrible results that poor Anne's friend had. So I just think that when we think about Roe v. Wade, we think about all the politics, all these arguments about the gray areas. But there are some very, very fundamental things that Roe v. Wade did, which is to save the lives of millions of women who would have otherwise died.
Friend, to you?
You know, if you actually look at statistics, and I know statistics back then were not as well kept, there weren't millions of women who died because of illegal abortions. Matter of fact, if you search for the facts, you find that number-wise, there were not very many at all. However, NARAL and Planned Parents' position has always been that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Well, let's talk about safety. Parental notification is a safety issue. A parent knows the medical history of that child and would know what to be looking for after an abortion for complications. Informed consent is to make sure that women really understand what they're getting into and what alternative choices that they might have. Licensure of facilities. New Hampshire facilities aren't licensed. Abortion should be done by physicians, not nurses. Waiting periods, give you a cool-down period. All of those things, those organizations oppose. Those are things that help towards the safety of it. And while you hear individual stories that are very poignant, how many people are we talking about that don't exist today because of abortion? 50 million babies. 50 million. This is not something that's rare.
Our caller said that she was old enough to remember when abortion was illegal. I want to ask you, Kevin Landrigan, what about younger people today? There's been a lot written about how younger generations are driving the nation toward broader acceptance of same-sex marriage, for example. We've seen big changes on this hot-button social issue. What about abortion? How are the younger generations moving this issue, if at all?
Well, certainly I think in this state, they seem to be moving the debate somewhat. As I said before, in a state such as New Hampshire that is historically been supportive of abortion rights, they're having less of an impact here. But I think we're seeing in other states they're having more of an impact by supporting personal freedom and personal privacy.
So maybe unclear as to how it's playing out younger generations in other states.
Yeah, I think it is unclear.
Yeah. You want to jump in, Susan?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think in this past year or two when contraception actually became a focal point of the anti-choice attack on women's reproductive choices, and I think that mobilized young women in a way we haven't seen in a while. I have a 20-year-old daughter who just talked about how so many of her friends who had never thought about this issue before suddenly went, I might not be able to get contraception. You know, whoa. That really was an awakening moment for a lot of young women in this up-and-coming generation. So it was bad, but it had a good impact in that sense.
More of your calls after a short break. Stay with us.
It's 9:39. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, hosting an information session for their Doctorate of Education program on February 9th. Information at nec.edu. And from Mediterranean Oriental Rugs in Keene, New Hampshire, featuring 3,000 new and antique rugs, open 9 to 5 every day through store closing. 603-357-5152. This is NHPR.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear from people who really make you think, like astrophysicist Brian Green explaining the scientific theory that our universe is just one of many.
And the image that I like to have in mind is, imagine that our universe is like one slice of bread in a much grander cosmic loaf, with the other slices of bread being other universes.
No subject is too big for Fresh Air. Join us weekdays at 3 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, former Vice President Al Gore on his life since he left politics and his new book called The Future. Email us your questions for Mr. Gore at nhpr.org and be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in the Exchange, the abortion debate in New Hampshire since Roe v. Wade 40 years ago this month. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. How have you seen this issue evolve, change here in New Hampshire? How do you think our state's attitude today compares to other states? And what role have you seen abortion playing in our politics over time? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And before we go back to our listeners, friend Wendell Bow, I did want to give you a chance to jump in on this issue of how younger generations are viewing abortion.
I think they're actually becoming more in line with recognizing the right to life. However, in this last election, birth control became an issue. And I saw some of the flyers that were handed out on college campuses that talked about that Republicans were against you being able to have birth control. There is a very narrow movement in the pro-life movement that believes that all birth control is an abortificant, that there is a potential when you're on birth control that after fertilization happens that the process of birth control, that fetus is then killed in zygote. However, I don't believe any Republican came out and said, we want to ban birth control. They wanted to not have taxpayers paying for birth control. Birth control is easily and readily and inexpensively, you know, available. And you've got all kind of money from family planning. Matter of fact, Planned Parenthood itself, when they were formed, actually were anti-abortion and more supportive of birth control for everyone to prevent abortions. So I think to say that people are anti-birth control and to mislead the youth, that those two are tied together, that if you have birth control, you're considered just like you're having an abortion, is really, really unfair.
Well, Kevin, this played a role in our most recent election, right? I mean, over the Montaigne, when he conceded defeat to now Governor Maggie Hassan, seemed to say that national pro-choice groups had helped bring his campaign down.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly, this issue played a significant role in this race. I think the Romney campaign as well sort of acknowledged after the election that New Hampshire went south and he lost by 6%, more than any poll really showed him losing, precisely because of the gender gap and mainly because of abortion. The Obama campaign really jumped on this issue of contraception and birth control that actually at the time House Speaker Bill O'Brien was championing with an ad that tried to link Romney to O'Brien. The Obama campaign had a national ad in swing states about footage of Mitt Romney talking about getting rid of Planned Parenthood. Those were his words in terms of budget cuts that he would support. I talked with folks in the Obama campaign. They said the numbers went off the chart for women supporting Obama after that ad. It's one of the reasons why it ran for a full month in New Hampshire, longer than in any other swing state, because it was driving that debate.
Well, lots and lots of calls, so let's go back to them. And Melissa's waiting in Bedford. Hi, excuse me, Melinda. Go ahead, Melinda, you're on the air.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. And it's funny because my question relates to what you have just been discussing. I personally do not consider abortion an option for me. But the reason why I've continued to support abortion rights is because it does appear as though many politicians, first of all, do not support more comprehensive sex education for girls, and they do seem to want to limit access to birth control. Now, one of your guests just mentioned that they just don't want taxpayers paying for birth control. So does that mean birth control is now only accessible to those who can pay for it, who have the insurance companies who are willing to cover it? Because I have taken birth control myself, and it is not cheap unless you have insurance. So what about women who do not currently have health insurance?
So, Melinda, in terms of abortion, you wouldn't have one yourself.
Right.
But you're uncomfortable with politicians who would take that away for everybody.
Mainly because they go on about how they are pro-life and how people who support abortion are not pro-life, and yet they have no interest, really, or do not seem to have any interest in supporting women before or after a pregnancy. It seems like their primary interest is to let the baby be born.
Okay, so the slippery slope issue, too, she's making there. Your thoughts, Fran?
You know, I think it's $9 a month at a number of major pharmacies. And, you know, we don't pay for condoms. It's the taxpayers that don't want to have to pay for these things. There'll always be some money for people who are very low income to get birth control, whether you have insurance or not, but totally with no insurance. Because I called a number of pharmacies, like $9.
You know, and I don't want to get too far into the contraception issue because we've done multiple shows on that topic. But here's the linkage that Democratic politicians, Susan, made in the last election. They made a politician's positions against abortion, linking him or her to a broader, you know, anti-choice, anti-women's health, they called it. And some conservatives said, hey, that's not fair. Don't take my anti-abortion position and turn it into a position against women's health. That's taking it too far.
Well, I would argue that that isn't taking it too far and that it actually goes beyond women's health. It goes right to the heart of women's autonomy. Because if you can't make a decision about when and or whether to bear children, how are you going to make decisions about college, about career, about marriage, about families? It's a very fundamental aspect of living one's life. And so I would argue that if you if one is not open to contraception and or women just making their own choices about their reproductive health, that you are, in fact, really going after women's fundamental autonomy and ability to be a player in our society and our economic world.
And Melinda, thank you for joining us. And let's go next to Rich in Melvin Village. Hi, Rich. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. I'm really upset with this whole thing because my wife and I just discussed this last night. It's cut and dry for me. Life begins at conception, and a baby has no rights to say whether he wants to be terminated or not. And the fetus has everything it needs at conception, so it's a real person. And would you kill a baby at birth because you didn't like the way it came out, or the sex, or there was something wrong with it? It's murder. It's purely murder, and that's my comment.
Rich, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
We talked earlier and throughout this hour about how even people who really feel like it's cut and dry for them sometimes favor exceptions or certain restrictions. What about you? 100% cut and dry? What if the mother, for example, was a teenager who'd been raped by her uncle?
Okay, rape and incest would be a horrible thing, but I still say that baby needs to be born and sent out for adoption. Something you can't just kill life because it's either inconvenient or somebody unfortunately, and I sympathize with women who have these horrible things done to them, but that's still a life. And that mother, that baby has its own DNA. It's a separate person, and that baby deserves to be born.
Okay. Thanks a lot for jumping in, Rich. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
And again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Lorna, who says, so if pro-life, she puts in quotes, pro-life people want to consider the unborn child the same as a, quote, living human being, can we then charge the mother with providing liquor to minors if she drinks? Can we then start restricting what a pregnant woman can eat, drink, or do? Lorna says, I don't see this issue resolving anytime soon. Fran, what do you think? And then I have a question for you, Kevin.
Actually, there's been a number of court cases and arrests of women who were obviously pregnant and were drunk or smoking.
Arrest saying you're endangering your fetus's life.
You're endangering your baby's life. So
in New Hampshire, have we seen those?
I don't know that I recall them in New Hampshire, but those are part of the bigger question. And, we had an incident here in New Hampshire where a woman was in a car accident, hit by a drunk driver going 100 miles an hour. Her child was born, was put on life support, lived for 2 weeks, and the gentleman who was charged with 2 counts of manslaughter appealed it, and the court overturned it because when the court read our law, they decided that that baby had never really been alive under the language of New Hampshire law. So there are so very many gray areas. But, you know, that family was devastated. It was a baby they wanted. It was a baby that had had a birth certificate, a death certificate, a funeral, and then to be told that baby never really existed.
Yeah, well, and there are so many laws that differ from state to state, as you just mentioned, our law here in New Hampshire. Susan, you know, as we get close to wrapping up, can you describe for us just what a patchwork abortion law is in this country today? 40 years since Roe v. Wade, you look at a map, every state has just a complex set of laws and rules and regulations.
Yes, and that's really been a lot of the interpretation of Roe that has come since the initial decision. I mentioned some cases earlier in the hour, the Casey decision in Pennsylvania, Webster in Missouri, where and decisions about allowing the fact that Medicaid does not have to pay for poor women's abortions. So a lot of interpretation has gone on, and as a result of that has given more and more latitude to states to regulate and restrict. The sort of coinage we've often used is chipping away at choice, and that's really what a lot of these bills and laws are about, is to just keep redefining and making ever smaller the box where women do have access to abortion services. The fact of the matter is that 80% of the counties in this country do not have abortion providers at this time. There are whole states, I think, like Mississippi, where there is one. This is the result of a lot of things happening at the state level, which, you know, Roe was really brought in order to remove. That's how it was pre-Roe, was that states made the rules around abortion access, and they were a patchwork. And the part of the reason Roe was brought as a case was to say, you know, this is about a woman's fundamental right to privacy, a constitutionally protected right. So it's very unfortunate to see what's been happening. But I will say that, you know, New Hampshire remains a very pro-choice state. You know, the exit polling at the 2012 election, 72% of those coming out of the polls said they supported women's reproductive choices. And that gets back to our fundamental small C conservative approach to government, which is small government, personal liberties, personal autonomy, keep the government out of my private life. And that is what the pro-choice position is, and that's why we have had such traction here in New Hampshire over many, many years, because we are in complete sync with a very fundamental facet of how New Hampshire approaches government.
What does that say to you, though, Susan, that so many other states have restricted access to abortion to the point where very few counties nationwide have abortion services available? Does that suggest that most people in the country disagree with you, if so many states have restricted this so much?
No. I mean, I think, again, the polling is, you know, it is, a lot of it depends on how you ask the question, obviously, as we well know. But I think we continue to see that it's very much of a tipping point kind of issue. It goes above and below, but it's always, it's, there's no question it's divisive. But I would argue that, you know, a lot of the restrictions and legislation is occurring in part because, well, what should I say, the squeaky wheel gets more attention. So the folks who feel that they are fighting the fight against Roe, you know, have a certain sort of vocalness to, whereas women who go, oh, this issue's been decided, I have constitutional protection under Roe v. Wade, they're not making as much noise. So there is perhaps a discrepancy in the activism around this issue that's a result of Roe v. Wade, and that's certainly something that my organization has really tried to make sure we didn't lose, that we need to be engaged in the political process to protect women's reproductive rights, because that's where it's happening.
And Fran, to the national picture, I know you're a New Hampshire politician, but nationally, it's a patchwork. It's very different all around the country.
It is very different. And, you know, as Susan just talked about, there are so few abortion procedures done in certain states, but you don't hear about all these people dying from illegal abortions that were done by people because there weren't any legal places. It just doesn't happen.
Well, maybe they're traveling to the places
where
it is taken.
And they could be, and it's unfortunate if they do travel to states who don't have strong regulation of it to protect them health-wise. But, you know, Susan talked about the polling again. I would love to see the question they were asked, because I think when the exit polls were asked, if it was, do you support totally unlimited and unrestricted abortion, do you support that? I don't think you would get anywhere near 72%. You would get a very narrow percentage who believes anywhere, anytime, any reason. I think the larger number of people are the ones who, in various degrees, agree to some restrictions.
Well, and as we've talked about, and as we've heard from our callers, I feel like I'm in one camp, but I would support this. Or I feel like I'm on the other side, but I would support that. Kevin, this year in New Hampshire, as we said earlier, abortion was a big issue in last year's legislative session. What about this new legislative session that just kicked off? Is abortion going to be an issue at all?
There's only one bill, actually, we know of that's been filed that deals with mandatory information for someone at least 24 hours before they have an abortion. It's sponsored by...
This is for adult women, not teens.
This is for all women.
We do have parental notification on the books.
That's correct. We do. And this bill, I think, is unlikely to pass. It's kind of pretty pejorative against healthcare providers that provide abortion. Refers to untrained and unprofessional counselors whose really only job is to sell or promote abortion. I don't think that kind of language is going to survive here. I think there will be an effort, perhaps not this year, more likely next year in the election year, to repeal the parental notification law. I'd be very surprised if that's not sponsored next year. And that vote is going to be very close in the state Senate, where the 13 Republicans, 11 Democrats. Right now, most people think it could be 12-12 or 13-11. But the debate will continue on past a parental notification law. I think there'll be debate particularly about abortion for very young women and whether there should be some kind of information or counseling of those women, even if they're not able to notify a parent.
Well, the issue won't go away. We can all agree on that. And I want to thank, this is not an easy topic, so I really, really appreciate all of you coming in, spending some time with me this morning. Kevin Landrigan, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, lead writer for the lobbynh.com. Fran Wendelbo, thank you also for your time.
Oh, it's been wonderful talking about an issue so important to so many people.
Fran Wendelbo,
Assistant
Secretary of the New Hampshire Republican State Committee, a former Republican rep from New Hampton, and Susan Arnold, thank you also for being
here. Thank you very much, Laura. Glad to be here.
Susan Arnold, Chair of NARAL Pro-Choice New Hampshire. This is The Exchange on NHPR.